Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the Standing Committee on Justice and Human Rights as we launch our study into the issue of online hate. This is a really important issue with increasing numbers of hate crimes being reported in Canada, with groups feeling vulnerable, and with the increasing presence of hate on the internet. This is a subject that the Standing Committee on Justice and Human Rights wanted to tackle. Je connais qu'il y avait des demandes partout au Canada, des groupes pour...
We have been asked to begin a review on this subject. Today, we have three groups with us, and maybe a fourth will join us this morning. They have requested this type of review.
By representing the Center for Israel and Jewish Affairs, Mr. Shimon Kofler-Fogel, President and Chief Executive Officer, and Mr. Richard Marceau, Vice President, External Affairs and General Counsel. Welcome, gentlemen. From the Anglican Church of Canada, we're joined by Mr. Ryan Weston, the lead animator, public witness for social and ecological justice. Welcome. And from the Canadian Rabbinic Caucus, we're joined by Rabbi Idan Sher. Welcome. And we may be joined by the Ahmadiyya Muslim Jamaat, represented by Imam Farhan Iqbal. And if he comes here, he will follow the other members of the panel in testifying. So we will start with Sija. And Mr. Fogel, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you to the members of the committee for inviting us to join this important conversation. I'm pleased to offer reflections on behalf of the Center for Israel and Jewish Affairs, CEJA, which is the advocacy agent of the Jewish Federations of Canada and represents more than 150,000 Jewish Canadians from coast to coast. CEJA is encouraged by the launch of this important study. Since the horrific mass shootings at the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh last October, the deadliest act of anti-Semitic violence in North American history, CEJA has mobilized thousands of Canadians to email the Justice Minister to call for a national strategy to counter online hate, beginning with this very study. We've done so with the endorsement of a diverse coalition of partners, including Muslim, Christian, Sikh, and LGBTQ plus organizations. It's also worth noting that various groups we have worked with to mark Genocide Awareness Month, including Ukrainian, Armenian, Roma, Rwandan, and Yazidi representatives, have united to call for a national strategy on online hate, knowing that genocide begins with words. Increasingly, terrorist organizations and hate groups rely on online platforms to spread their toxic ideas, recruit followers, and incite violence. This is a problem that spans the ideological spectrum. For example, Canadians who have been radicalized to join ISIS have often done so after extensively consuming jihadist content online. In the case of two recent acts of white supremacist terrorism, the mass murder of Jews in Pittsburgh and Muslims in Christchurch, the killers made extensive use of social media to promote their heinous ideology. The Pittsburgh shooter reportedly posted more than 700 anti-Semitic messages online over a span of 9 months leading up to the attack. And the Christchurch shooter's decision to live stream his horrific crime was a clear attempt to provoke similar atrocities. We cannot afford to be complacent, given the link between online hate and real-world violence. My hope is that this study will culminate in a unanimous call on the Government of Canada to establish a comprehensive strategy to counter online hate and provide the government with proposed outline for that strategy. Today, I'd like to share four elements that we believe are essential to include: defining online hate, tracking online hate, preventing online hate, and intervening against online hate. First, a national strategy should clearly define online hate and not assume that online platforms have the capacity to navigate these waters on their own. The focus should not be on insensitive, inappropriate, or even offensive content, for which counter speech is generally the best remedy. The explicit goal should be to counter those who glorify violence and deliberately, often systematically, demonize entire communities. While freedom of expression is a core democratic value, authorities must act in exceptional circumstances to protect Canadians from those who willfully promote hate propaganda and seek to radicalize vulnerable individuals. The international community's experience in defining anti-Semitism is an important model. The International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance, IHRA, its working definition of anti-Semitism, which is the world's most widely accepted definition of Jew hatred, should be included in any strategy to tackle online hate. It's a practical tool that social media providers can use to enforce user policies prohibiting hateful content, and that Canadian authorities can use to enforce relevant legal provisions. Second, a national strategy requires enhanced tracking and reporting of online hate via strategic partnerships between the Government of Canada and technology companies. There are models worth reviewing and developing a Canadian approach, such as TACT, the Tech Against Terrorism Initiative, a UN-mandated program that engages online companies to ensure their platforms are not exploited by extremists. Third, a national strategy must include prevention. In the current global environment, trust in traditional media and institutions has declined as online manipulation and misinformation has increased. A campaign to strengthen internet literacy and critical online thinking with resources to support parents and educators would help mitigate these trends. Fourth, a national strategy must include a robust and coordinated approach to intervention and disruption. There's a debate over whether government regulation or industry self-regulation is the best approach. Canada can benefit from the experience of other democracies, especially in Europe, that are further down the road in developing policy responses to online hate. Their successes and setbacks should be considered in crafting a Made in Canada approach. The solutions, whether regulatory, legislative, or industry-based, will flow from open and inclusive discussion with governments, service providers, consumers, and groups like CEJA, who represent frequently targeted segments of society. The committee will likely discuss the former Section 13 of the Canadian Human Rights Act. CEJA has long held the view, as we stated years ago during the debate over rescinding Section 13, that removing this provision leaves a gap in the legal toolbox. There are multiple legitimate ways to remedy this. One is to enhance training for police and Crown prosecutors to ensure more robust, consistent use of Criminal Code hate speech provisions. Three recent criminal convictions in Ontario, one for advocating genocide and two for willful promotion of hatred, demonstrate that these sections of the Criminal Code remain an effective vehicle for protecting Canadians. Similarly, Section 320.1 of the Criminal Code, which enables the courts to seize computer data believed on reasonable grounds to house hate propaganda, is a pragmatic tool that should be applied more often. Another approach is to develop a new provision in the Canadian Human Rights Act on online hate. This requires addressing the clear deficiencies of Section 13, which was an effective but flawed instrument. In line with recommendations offered by the Honorable Erwin Kotler, a restored Section 13 would require significant safeguards to protect legitimate freedom of expression and prevent vexatious use of the section. I know there are strong feelings on both sides of the House towards Section 13. This need not be a partisan issue. With the right balance, a reasonable consensus can be achieved. And I emphasize the need for consensus because the use of legal measures to counter online hate will only be truly effective if those tools enjoy broad legitimacy among Canadians. If misused, misconstrued, or poorly constructed, any new legal provisions, including a renewed Section 13, would risk undermining the overarching goal to protect Canadians and prevent hate propagandists from gaining sympathizers and adherents. While Canada has not seen the same polarization that has marked American or European politics, we are not immune to it, and the growth of anti-Semitism and other forms of hate in mainstream discourse that comes with it. History has repeatedly shown that Jews and other minorities are at grave risk in times of political upheaval and popular disillusionment with public institutions. With advances in technology, these processes now unfold with alarming speed and global reach. The tactics of terrorists and hate groups have evolved, and so too must public policy. While there's no way to fully mitigate the threat of hate-motivated violence, a strong national strategy to combat online hate would make a meaningful difference. Chairman, members of the committee, I thank you for your time and would welcome any questions during the Q&A.
Thank you very much. We will now move to the Anglican Church and Mr. Weston.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee for the invitation this morning to speak to you about our concerns as the Anglican Church of Canada with the proliferation of hate online and the very real impacts of this hatred for communities in this country and around the world. We're honored to join with the voices of so many other diverse organizations in calling for stronger action on this issue across Canada. Our religious tradition teaches that every person is imbued with inherent dignity and also particularly calls us to embody special care and concern for those who find themselves uniquely vulnerable to harm or attack. Additionally, as Christians, our faith community has enjoyed a historically privileged position in this country, and so we recognize that we have a particular responsibility to speak out for the protection of others. If we are to take these commitments seriously, we must raise our voices to oppose hatred in all its forms. As you all well know, recent years have seen a proliferation of extreme forms of hatred in online fora that encourage violence and dehumanize those who are the targets of this hate. Recent high-profile violent attacks in Canada and abroad have emphasized the reality that these sentiments do not remain online, but have tragic offline consequences as well, and that they are in need of immediate and sustained attention. We join with many of the other witnesses here today in calling for the federal government to develop a national strategy to combat online hatred. This government has the ability to impose reasonable regulation on social media corporations, internet service providers, and other relevant corporate actors to control the proliferation of violent hate speech in online spaces. The government must also develop a strategy for more effective enforcement of existing laws regarding the public incitement of hatred, with particular attention given to the ways these attitudes are expressed online, so these activities will not go unchallenged. In order to be effective, any national strategy will also work in partnership with other stakeholders, recognizing that responsibility for combating hatred, both online and off, does not rest solely with the government. Corporations, including the large social media companies, must update their terms of use and their monitoring and reporting activities in order to better control the dissemination of hate through their networks and to remove hateful posts and users. Faith communities and civil society organizations must also affirm our commitment to combating hate in the communities that we serve and to use our voice and influence to challenge such expressions wherever we encounter them. Recognizing that many of the hateful words and actions directed towards the communities impacted by hate speech are carried out in the name of religion, the active participation of faith communities and interfaith coalitions is essential to effectively combating this reality. We commit to continuing our work with ecumenical and interfaith partners in addressing these attitudes within our own communities, and we draw strength from the leadership and witness of many Canadian faith groups who have been actively working to combat hate and oppression for many years, some of which are appearing before you today. It's also important to remember that hatred online is never completely detached from hatred offline. Hatred that is being promoted among sympathetic networks or directed at individuals and communities in the streets of our country. Although online hatred presents new challenges in terms of the ready accessibility of such extreme views, the roots of these attitudes are based on arguments and myths with long and influential histories in Canada and around the world. We must confront these attitudes at every opportunity. A national strategy to address online hatred then must also equip families, community leaders, and individual Canadians to challenge expressions of hatred, extremism, and violence wherever they may encounter it. Education and awareness must be a key part of any strategy to address this issue, equipping people with the tools they need to dismantle these ideologies. While I've been speaking about online hate in fairly broad terms this morning, we must also name that there are specific communities being targeted by these sentiments. And so any national strategy to combat this hatred will only be effective in as much as it recognizes the specific realities and repercussions of particular forms of hatred. Although an overarching strategy is certainly necessary in this work, we must also develop integrated strategies that address and debunk the myths underpinning anti-Indigenous racism, anti-Black racism, anti-Semitism, misogyny, Islamophobia, homophobia and transphobia, xenophobia and anti-immigrant sentiment, religious intolerance, and other forms of hatred that have distinct impacts on the safety and security of identifiable groups of people in this country. The Anglican Church of Canada is increasingly attending to the importance of online presence as a positive means of communication and education, And so supporting the development and implementation of a national strategy to combat hatred online is a natural step in this work for us. We recognize that we have the ability to reach thousands of Canadians through our services and programs across the country, as well as with our online presence. We are committed to continuing to lift up a vision of this country and this world that truly welcomes and respects everyone by offering safe, supportive spaces for all Canadians and by challenging expressions of hatred directly. If we fail to take more concerted action in this country to combat all forms of hate, online and in person, then further high-profile acts of violence will embolden similar action from others. We must all work together to offer a positive, loving alternative to this hate, an alternative that affirms the inherent dignity of all persons in Canada and around the world. Such an alternative requires strong strategic direction from government that supports efforts by all stakeholders to challenge these attitudes. We are ready to collaborate in this work together with our prayers, our pulpits, and our presence online. But only by working together can we confront this important issue and make our world a little bit safer for so many. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We'll now move to the Canadian Rabbinic Caucus and Rabbi Sher.
Thank you for having me today. I represent the Canadian Rabbinic Caucus, a group of around 200 rabbis from across the country and from across the Jewish denominational spectrum. On October 27th, 2018, 11 Jews were murdered at Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. The murderer had been highly active in promoting anti-Semitism on social media. It's reported that he posted more than 700 anti-Semitic messages online in the 9 months or so prior to the attack. Just 2 hours before the attack, the murderer foreshadowed his actions in his final disturbing online post. On Friday, March 15th, 50 Muslims were murdered by a white nationalist terrorist at two mosques in Christchurch, New Zealand. These murders played out as a dystopian reality show delivered by some of America's biggest technology companies. YouTube, Facebook, Reddit, and Twitter all had roles in publicizing the violence and, by extension, the hate-filled ideology behind it. The shooter also released a 74-page manifesto denouncing Muslims and immigrants that spread widely online. He left behind a social media trail on Twitter and Facebook that amounted to footnotes to his manifesto. And over the 2 days before the shooting, he posted about 60 of the same links across different platforms, nearly half of which were to YouTube videos that were still active many hours after the shooting. As these horrific attacks demonstrate, hate can be lethal, and online hate can foreshadow mass violence. There is no question that the internet has become the newest frontier for inciting hate that manifests itself disturbingly offline. In 2017, the World Jewish Congress, representing Jewish communities in 100 countries, they released a report indicating that 382,000 anti-Semitic posts were uploaded to social media in 2016. Stated differently, that's one anti-Semitic post every 83 seconds. Although the information on online hate in Canada is limited, according to Cision Canada, a Toronto-based PR software and service provider, there was a 600% rise in intolerant hate speech and social media postings by Canadians between 2015 and 2016. The architect of the study explains that while some of that intolerant and hateful speech was generated by bots, as determined by analyzing the high frequency of posts over a short time, the researchers noted that the bot's language was later mimicked by human users, and therefore it was just as destructive. These numbers are staggering. The Canadian government rightfully prides itself as a global thought and action leader in the area of protecting the rights, the safety, the quality of life of the people both within its borders and worldwide. And we, personally, we have felt this. Canadian law enforcement agencies have been exceptionally responsive in providing support to our institutions, particularly following the Pittsburgh attack. However, what is now needed is for federal policymakers to prevent similar atrocities by launching a national strategy to combat online hate. The explosive growth of digital communications has coincided with rising alienation from traditional media and institutions. Extremists have taken advantage, preying on the vulnerable, disaffected individuals through the same digital tools and collaborative online culture that now shapes so much of our world. There is, of course, no way to fully eliminate the threat of hate-motivated violence, but a strong national strategy to combat online hate can make a meaningful difference in protecting Canadians. The Center for Israel and Jewish Affairs, CIJA, has set out a four-step policy recommendation towards fighting online hate. Step one of that recommendation is defining hate. One very important prong of this step is for the Canadian government to define what constitutes hate. This should begin with the adoption of the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance, or IHRA's, definition of antisemitism. The IHRA definition is a practical tool that should be used by Canadian authorities in enforcing the law, and as well by social media providers in implementing policies against hateful content. The further steps of CIJA's recommendation include tracking hate, preventing hate, and intervening to stop hate. On that last step, intervening to stop hate, I'd like to make it very clear that we are not looking to police distasteful speech. Freedom of expression is, of course, a core Canadian value. We are focused on the glorification of violence and systematic propaganda affecting Jews and other communities. We are confident that an effective balance can be struck between protecting free speech and combating online hate that demonizes entire communities and leads to violence and murder. This, of course, is a complex issue, but we are calling on the government of Canada to take the lead on understanding it and developing the tools to counter it. We are calling on the government of Canada to launch a national strategy to tackle online hate, working in partnership with social media platforms and internet service providers, and as well with other appropriate partners. This is a crucial step in making a difference that we so badly need. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Rabbi. And then we will move to the Ahmadiyya Muslim Jamaat. And we've been joined by Imam Farhan Iqbal. Imam Iqbal, your floor is yours.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum. Peace and blessings of God be on all of you. I would like to start off by recognizing this Committee of Justice and Human Rights on behalf of the Ahmadiyya Muslim Jamaat. As an imam of the Ahmadiyya Muslim Jamaat Canada, I would like to offer our heartfelt regards and thankfulness for giving us the opportunity to share our thoughts on this important, pertinent matter. There's no doubt that over the last decade, we have seen an exponential rise of hate crimes in our society. If we look at the statistics around terrorism, gang violence, gun violence, we see a general, albeit worrying, upwards trend. Similarly, and sometimes overlooked, with the dawn of the internet and social media, we have seen a stark rise in online hate speech and violence as well. To start off, we can quickly discuss what really is hate speech, as was mentioned earlier as well. Where do we draw the line between freedom of speech versus hate speech? Hate speech that refers to abusive or threatening speech or writing that expresses prejudice against a particular group. To put into perspective how dangerous this is, according to a Maclean's article online, online hate speech rose 600% in Canada. Some of the words that they monitored to demonstrate this rise are hashtag ban Muslims, hashtag white power. Most recently, as we are all aware of the rise of Islamophobia, which has hit home in Canada in Quebec City, it led up to the Quebec City mosque attack. There had been a surge in mosque arson and vandalism across Canada, and eventually it led to this attack. As recent as last week in London, UK, a right-wing extremist, Stephen Bishop, pled guilty to a plot to carry out a bomb attack at the Beit al-Futuh Mosque, which is one of Great Britain's largest mosques belonging to the Ahmadiyya Muslim Jamaat. Ahmadi Muslims believe that free speech is sacred freedom insofar as it provides an indispensable flow to a human's thoughts and is a force for good. Hate speech and ideology designed to cause harm and grief must not be allowed to use the disguise of freedom of speech. We all recognize the imminent and very real threat of hate speech. How can we solve it? Is there a way to solve this problem by putting together a 30, 60, 90-day plan? Most probably not. And that's because this effort is not about bending heads, it's about changing minds. To combat the rise of hate crimes online and in person, we need to respect our differences and continue to stay true to our notion of acceptance. Ignorance breeds suspicion, fear, and anger. Familiarity breeds understanding, compassion, and love. When people come together and find out how similar we are, it is only then we can truly have feelings of sympathy, understanding, compassion, and love. This is the way to combat hate. We need to open our doors and our hearts. We need to interact with one another with unconditional love. We need to recognize the rights of one another. To truly combat the rise of hate crimes, we need to accept that this is not something that will be fixed overnight. Rather, it is something that will require a daily and regular struggle, which will help shape the way that we think and interact with one another. Once we start to truly embody the profound saying of love for all, hatred for none, it is only then that we can start to tackle the rise of hate crimes. Together, we are stronger than any one individual. Love is much stronger than fear. Fear demands we think of ourselves as separate somehow from one another. By coming together, our common bond increases our capacity for love to be dominant and allows us to live together in peace and harmony. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Imam. And I'd like to thank all of the different members of the panel for their very important contributions. And we're going to move to questions. And we're going to start with Mr. Cooper.
Okay. Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you to the witnesses. I certainly agree that this is an important study, that all Canadians should be extremely concerned by the proliferation of hate that has worrisomely increased in the last number of years. It has hit home in communities across Canada, most significantly in the horrific mosque attack in Quebec City. We saw it just 8 hours away in Pittsburgh at the Tree of Life Synagogue, which I know well because it's about a block or a couple of blocks from where my brother lives. And so it's important that we tackle this issue. And while we do so, of course, we have to be cognizant, as I think all witnesses indicated, about fundamental freedoms, including freedom of speech, and how do we strike that balance. And perhaps I'll begin by asking Mr. Fogel. You did mention Section 13, and with respect, I believe that section is a flawed section for a number of reasons. But you mentioned that with the removal of what many believe to be a flawed section of the Canadian Human Rights Act, that there is a gap. Now, when you look at Section 318 or 319, or I think you cited Section 320.1 of the Criminal Code, I'd just be interested in understanding where you see the gap, and perhaps you could elaborate on what you would recommend in terms of closing what you state as a gap.
So thank you for the question. You know, from our perspective, we were pretty agnostic about whether at the time that it was debated, Section 13 was tweaked to be responsive to some of the deficiencies inherent in the section, or whether, if it was abandoned, the criminal code provisions were provided with a more robust capacity to compensate for the loss of Section 13. Essentially, the problem is one that you've actually referenced, and I think would be familiar to everybody on the committee. We are dealing with two competing imperatives. On the one hand, the desire to ensure that people can avail themselves of the freedom to express thoughts and ideas freely, without fear of persecution or prosecution, however odious those ideas might be. On the other hand, and unlike our American cousins, we recognize that there is a limit to freedom of expression, that when it begins to encroach on the safety and security, the well-being of others, that really constitutes a red line. And the challenge with Section 13 was that it was both a sword and a shield. So it was providing some insulation for those who really did have malicious intent and wasn't offering the protection to those who were the targets of toxic or vitriolic hatred. We had hoped that government writ large, because it's not just a federal issue, it applies on the provincial and municipal levels as well. We had hoped that they would come forward and demonstrate a real political will to pick up the slack from the loss of Section 13. In fact, we wrote, I think Richard wrote to the attorneys general across the country, calling on them to adopt a more aggressive posture in terms of considering and acting upon potential hate crime activity that would be able to compensate for the loss of Section 13. And frankly, that hasn't been our experience. There has been some, but not enough. So if we are to return to a Section 13 kind of model, we would want to ensure that there are provisions with respect to evidence, with respect to onus of ensuring that it was not a slap or vexatious kind of lawsuit that really would protect the ability of individuals and groups to articulate ideas, even if they didn't meet with uniform positive response. And there were a number of other things that I think that the committee could look back to in the testimony that was given by a variety of different stakeholders that could offer a solution. But what is clear is that government, again, writ large, has to be able to employ useful tools, tools that do make a distinction between freedom of expression and freedom from hate as they proceed along this line. And I know this is straying just a moment from just a little bit from your question, but what we should note is increasingly the call from social media providers, the platforms that we are all talking about ubiquitously, who themselves are struggling to figure out what the lines are and where they should be intervening and what should be their response to things that appear online. And I think that there is a signal that they're looking for leadership from government to help provide them with the guidance necessary for them to put into place, whether it's human resources or algorithms or what have you. The numbers are staggering. I've reviewed some of the stuff from Facebook alone in terms of the hundreds of millions of posts. And the idea, I mean, it's hard to wrap your head around monitoring and responding to that volume of information. So some clear guidelines from government, and I'll return to the issue of the IRA definition of anti-Semitism. One of the benefits that it provides a government is that it offers a clear definition. So you can then use that as a template for the algorithms that you're going to put into place and the word searches that you're going to use to trigger closer scrutiny and so forth. And if we were to do this across the span, looking at those specific things to which different communities, whether it's LGBTQ or the Muslim community, the Baha'i, and so forth, I think that we would go a long way in being able to entrench the kind of distinctions on freedom from hate and freedom of expression that everybody around this table, I suspect, is rightly concerned about.
Thank you very much. By a lot.
I'll give you some of mine this afternoon.
Mr. Varani.
So I'm going to put the timer on because I know there's a lot of strong advocates at the table. So first of all, welcome. Thank you for being here. Salaam alaikum, shalom. Thank you for being here. It's really, really important. This is something that I take seriously, Canadians take seriously, my constituents in Park Eli Park take very, very seriously. And I know all of you are here with the best of intentions. We are seeing an unbelievable amount of hatred. I'm glad you outlined many aspects of it, whether it's anti-Semitism, whether it's Islamophobia, whether it's homophobia, transphobia, anti-Indigenous sentiment, anti-Black sentiment, incel movements, etc. These are a cause for huge concern right here in Canada because of the attacks we've seen in Quebec, what we've seen in Pittsburgh, what we've seen in New Zealand. There was, at one point, a tool. And I want to pick up on this, but I'm going to hold you to a bit of a time limit there, Mr. Fogel. But there was a bit of a tool that was applied in the previous iteration of the Canada Human Rights Act, Section 13, which talked about targeted discrimination based on a prohibited ground towards an identifiable group that was spread by means of a telecommunication. And it emphasized that this includes the internet. That provision was removed by the previous government in and around 2012, 2013. At the time, it had gone through some challenges. And previous iterations of the groups that are here, including B'nai B'rith, the Canadian Jewish Congress, and the Friends of Simon Wiesenthal, as early as 2006, were defending that very provision. And in a decision called Whatcott by the Supreme Court of Canada, the analog to that very provision was upheld on the very basis that have been discussed. So I want to know your sense of, is your perspective that that was an invalid provision? So perhaps over to Sija, and if it wasn't invalid, if you can drive at the heart of what you think needs to be added in to make it more robust.
So very, very briefly, and I apologize for my lengthy answers, but nobody gives me time to speak at home. So, Section 13 was critically important, and it provided the protections that you just referenced, and I think that it is clear that Canadians and groups within Canada need them. The problem was that, ironically, groups that we should be concerned about or individuals we should be concerned about were using Section 13 as a way of pushing back against those who were raising legitimate free expression ideas or concerns about particular topics. So it was chilling or more precisely, freezing the ability of people to offer critical comment about things of public interest without fear of being brought before some judicial process to account for what they said because others were claiming, well, that's triggering hate against us. And that was the vulnerability of Section 13. There were a whole range of ways to deal with it. You have them in front of you. You've clearly done the research, and I would invite the committee to look carefully at those because either it has to be brought back in a better construct, and Erwin Kotler's formulation, I won't go through it now, some of you are familiar with it and you can easily access it, was probably the most compelling way to restructure Section 13, or provide direction to law enforcement, to the public prosecution process, to the attorneys general, to become much more aggressive and active in applying the provisions of the criminal code.
Okay, so I'm going to stop you there. So I have two more areas that I want to canvass. We talked a bit about social media companies, and perhaps I'm going to ask the Canadian Rabbinical Caucus to address this one. But there is examples of different jurisdictions that regulate social media companies much more vigorously. Germany comes to mind because of their history with anti-Semitism and Nazism, and their regulations have compelled Facebook to be much more robust in the human resources they dedicate to this issue. What can we learn from examples like that, like in Germany?
Yeah, so I think again, pointing to the Center for Israel and Jewish Affairs policy statement, policy recommendation statement with their four steps, they actually speak extensively. They actually write extensively on both Germany as well as some of the projects that the UN has been involved with, and I believe that Mr. Fogel mentioned those as well. And I think there's a lot to be learned. Some of the European countries are definitely further along than Canada is in these areas, and there are certainly ways to create a made for Canada, made in Canada type of approach, but using the lessons of other countries and the UN as well.
Okay, and the last point I want to raise is that we talked about, a number of you picked up on Mr. Fogel's theme, which is talking about preventing and in fact intervening. There is a white supremacist strand to a lot of what we're seeing around the world. We have had people in this country as recently as this week questioning about the presence of white supremacy. So I want to know from various people at the table, is there white supremacy in this country? And secondly, if there is white supremacy, what is the responsibility of elected legislators to denounce that very fact? The Ahmadiyya Muslim Jamaat wants to address that. No. I'll open it up to everyone.
I think, and I don't think I'll get in trouble for saying this, that yes, there is white supremacy in this country, and I think that that it's important to name that and to say that and to challenge it. And so I think the responsibility of the elected representatives as people who have been given voice by those that you represent is to stand up to that. And so the government has a clear role, I think, in challenging that ideology and countering that ideology and offering an alternative, a counter-narrative that gives us something else to aspire to and something else to build relationships with rather than a white supremacist ideology.
Thank you very much. Ms. Ramsey?
Thank you all for being here this morning and for your presentations. I mean, you know, picking up kind of on that thread, I think we saw this week an attempt from Facebook to address some of the groups in Canada that are sharing this information online. We saw the banning of individuals and groups, which I think was a very good move. It wasn't across all social media platforms, unfortunately. I think it was Facebook and Instagram that did that. But to Mr. Fogel's point earlier, you know, the depths that exist in the internet, even amongst one platform itself, you know, it's just layers upon layers of, you know, social media giants trying to control this themselves. And you know, it really begs the question about how they can do this on their own without government intervention, without the Canadian government being a part of that. And I think having some basic rules around what is acceptable and what isn't, some ground rules for platforms in our own country. Because, you know, when you all spoke about Pittsburgh and the Christchurch shooting and the extensive amount of Islamophobic and anti-Semitic material that had been posted by both of these individuals. And I think what Canadians are asking is, how is this happening, that this is all being posted? Why is no one going to these individuals and stopping it at that point? You know, is this a failure of social media? Is this a failure of policy? And they're also asking, how does this happen, that people are out there sharing these volumes of information and no one is challenging it? So I know that, you know, Mr. Fogel spoke to this, I think, clearly, but I wanted to ask the other panelists, do you think that online platforms should be able to establish their own policies to address online hate, or do you believe that Canada should establish some ground rules as well? Maybe the three gentlemen could speak to that.
Sure. So I think... I think that social media companies should be establishing their own rules. They need to establish their own rules, but that the government does have a role in pursuing legislation that sets a baseline of requirements for that, so that it's not relying solely on the goodwill of these corporations, but that it reflects the commitment of this country in terms of how we manage, especially communications and telecommunications. So I think there's a both and there.
I would agree with that. I also would like to, I mean, when I look at the history of social media companies trying to deal with these kind of things, it's not very promising. It's not that they have given us great results and they're doing this so well that, you know, there was a CBC documentary, I think, about this as well, about how these companies try to deal with provocative videos or violent videos and those kind of things. I mean, it deviates from what we're discussing, but it's because they are run for money. It's a business, really, and those kind of videos give them more viewers and more users and more engagement. So they tend not to take down all the controversial videos out there, all the violent videos out there. And they keep some of them so that they can keep on engaging their audience. So it's when it comes to these companies, it's a question mark, really, how much we want to rely on them to make the perfect rules. I think the government should have some involvement as well.
So it seems that the mainstream social media platforms do have terms of use. They do have certain regulations and requirements, but it does seem very clear as well that they just cannot seem to keep up with what is going on as far as online hate is concerned. So that being the case, echoing both actually what all of the witnesses have said is I think we need to see government taking a leadership position. Of course, it will be in partnership with social media platforms, internet service providers, and other appropriate partners, but I definitely think that government will need to take the lead in this collaborative approach to actually being able to keep up with the monitoring and fighting of online hate.
Thank you. If I may, Ms. Ramsey, In September 2018, a report was produced and given to the Prime Minister of France on online hate, and they are due to present a bill in the next few weeks. Some of the elements that when I was reading through the report were interesting for and actually quite simple to help for. One of their recommendations would be to have a universal logo on all those platforms that you click if what is written is hateful, so that helps those internet companies. Another suggestions that they have that you know might be interesting to look at is that a time limit imposed on companies to take away or take out or erase those comments. And another one that I looked and should be, I believe, looked at is a way to make the complaints online, so not have to go to the police, not have to drive down to the police station and make the complaints. So those are some of the elements that, in when you look at things to put in a national policy, that could that I would invite you to explore. They're simple and I think could be helpful.
It's Tracy's time, so also, you have to.
I wasn't sure if you were saying. Was that,
I was wondering if Mr. Fogel was trying to get your attention. That's as
if I can add two super quick comments. Look, two things about social media platforms. On the one hand, asking them to self-regulate and actually to in effect, censor some of the content is going directly against their business model, which is to expand as opposed to contract. And I think that we have to be sensitive to this. But I have discerned over the past 12 to 18 months a sea change, an evolution in the thinking of these platforms. I think that they're scared. They did not appreciate just how big they were getting, just how powerful a tool their platforms were. And I do not think that they have the confidence that they can do this on their own. And my sense from some of the testimony they've given in various legislatures around the world, but certainly here in North America, is that they are looking for some support and leadership from government. I think they need it both for insulation as well as for objective third-party adjudication, for lack of a better term, in order to help direct and guide how they're going to put into place the kind of infrastructure. And, you know, Facebook alone, just the other day I heard an interview where a senior employee at Facebook was talking about moving from 10,000 to 30,000 people with the dedicated task of reviewing posts online. It's crazy. So I think that they do need government support, and they don't see that as encroachment, but rather as helpful intervention.
Thank you very much. Ms. Khaled?
Thank you, Chair, and thank you to the witnesses for coming in today and for your very wise testimony. It was last year I was at a mosque with a fellow member of parliament, and we had our heads covered. And the fellow member of parliament refused to take a picture of me with me, and I can only speculate that it was because of fear of the online mob that was waiting to comment and to judge on what this member of parliament was doing at a mosque, for example, with a person like myself. So I ask you, in light of all of this this online hate, what is the role that public figures like myself, like other members of parliament, and like yourselves, what is the role that we play in combating this? We can talk about policy and effective laws to combat, but there's as Mr. Iqbal said, it's not about bending heads, it's about changing minds. How do we as role models or as community leaders take that initiative? And I'd like to know a little bit about what you are doing to proactively combat this kind of online hatred as well. And if we can go down the line, starting with Mr. Fogel.
So again, very briefly, there's a public conversation that has to take place. We always look to what we call thought leaders, who are going to help frame and guide the discussion. And I think, frankly, parliamentarians, public officials, are uniquely positioned to be able to set the terms of reference for the discussion. Because if you recall in my earlier remarks, I noted that this only works if there is broad buy-in on the part of Canadians. In some respects, this is a very scary subject because it brings to mind the idea of how intrusive into people's lives they can be, whether it's the internet providers, whether it's government and so forth. Because what you're really talking about is scrutinizing what people post, making a judgment or rendering a judgment on it, and then taking action about it. And that can be very intimidating. So in order to get that buy-in, I think that there has to be a, maybe not uniform, but certainly united set of messages that are being conveyed from the political sector that, A, talk about the need, but also talk about that it's safe for Canadians to be contemplating some regulation, some a regime or protocol that's going to govern this. And we, for our part, as was mentioned by Ryan, we have an obligation from our pulpits, from our community centers, from our schools, to be echoing that message at the more granular and local level.
Thank you. Mr. Scheer?
Yes. So as far as staying away from policy for a moment and what our role should be, certainly within our synagogues, we actively fight hate and we actively educate on the importance of these issues. It's often that, for instance, our synagogue, but we're just an example, serves as a platform of bringing different people together and educating ourselves about different types of Canadians and different people within our own communities. And those types of messages tend to be very, very important and quite striking when it comes to changing the tone of conversations and discussions and specifically around this issue. And as well as just as we do in our pulpits and our congregations, I think following that model on by parliamentarians and political leaders as well is very striking, just as you gave that example of being in a mosque and being a leader in that type of position and following suit in all of our different communities and making that very clear that this is something that the government of Canada stands for.
Thank you. Mr. Weston?
I mean, the short answer is that I wish that that person had shared the photo. That I think that that is a big part of the role of public figures is to make visible these relationships and to build those relationships and to normalize things that might be unfamiliar to people that are involved. And just last week, I was talking to one of our bishops, and he said that he's gotten to know the local rabbi and imam, but he's gotten to know them because they've attended so many vigils together. And they realized at one point that the only effective way that it's going to prevent any of this need for further vigils is if they have ongoing relationships with each other, where we're not strangers to one another. It's not an intimidating prospect. And so by sharing your presence in some of these places, that's effective. And by creating opportunity for people to build relationships with one another, that maybe public figures can be the meeting point rather than compelling people to go into a situation they may not be comfortable with, creating opportunities for people to be in a kind of neutral space and get to know one another so that it's not about an other person over there, but somebody that's right in front of you with whom you can relate.
Thank you. Mr. Iqbal?
Yeah, I would just echo what Mr. Weston was saying. There needs to be more interfaith dialogue. I think people in your position can certainly have a role to play in encouraging interfaith connections, interfaith dialogue. I myself, when I was in Toronto, I was part of this Toronto Area Interfaith Council for a couple of years, and the engagement that we had with the city, it enabled us to host the Parliament of World Religions in Toronto. And also after the unfortunate van attack in Toronto, it was the Toronto Area Interfaith Council that was able to bring so many people together in the square and have that event. So, you know, as vigils were mentioned as well, so vigils can only be successful if the different communities are coming together. And people who are in your position, they can help promote these kind of connections because you have so much, yourself have connection with the community and different faith groups. And if you help them come together, I think it can make a difference.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. I want to thank the members of the panel. You guys have been extraordinary in offering insight to us today. And I wish we had more time, but we have another panel that we've got to get up here. So I'm going to briefly suspend the meeting to change panels. I'd ask the members of the next panel to come forward. And I want to thank all of you very much for your help on this. Je vais donner tout le monde un préavis encore 2 minutes. On va commencer dans 1 minute. Donc je demanderai à tout le monde de prendre leur siège. I'll ask everybody to take their seats. We are now going to start our second panel on online hate. It is a pleasure to be joined by Amnesty International Canada with Mr. Alex Neave, the Secretary General. Welcome back. The Armenian National Committee of Canada is joining us by video conference from Toronto, represented by Mr. Shahin Merakian, who is the President. Welcome, Mr. Merakian. The Association for Reform Political Action Canada is joining us, represented by Mr. Andre Shudin, Legal Counsel and Director of Law and Policy. Welcome. And the Baha'i Community of Canada is joining us, and I'd like to welcome Mr. Jeffrey Cameron, who's Director of Office of Public Affairs. And so because what we normally do is we try to put the person on video conference first in case we unfortunately lose the video conference, we're going to ask Mr. Merakian to start. Mr. Merakian, around 8 minutes, please, sir. The floor is yours.
Oh, thank you. I won't need 8 minutes. Thank you to the chair and the members of the committee for inviting the Armenian National Committee of Canada to provide evidence to you today. My name is Shahin Merakian, and I am the president of the Armenian National Committee of Canada. I apologize for not being able to join you in person today. As representatives of a community that has suffered genocide, the ultimate expression of hate-based violence, we are more familiar than most with the consequences of the promotion of hate. Similarly, as a community that has routinely advocated for positions that run counter the status quo, we are fierce defenders of freedom of expression. In our view, there is no contradiction in these two positions. Hate propaganda is a means of infringing the freedom of expression of the targeted group. By delegitimizing or vilifying identifiable groups, hate propaganda makes it impossible for members of those groups to be heard or participate in civil society in a meaningful fashion. Canada's history of protecting freedom of speech and freedom of expression while criminalizing the willful incitement of hate or advocation of genocide has been a powerful example for the international community. Now Canada has to apply the lessons learned from nearly 50 years of combating hate in the real world to the virtual world and develop a national strategy to address online hate. As you are aware, on April 24, 2015, the House of Commons adopted motion M587, calling upon the government to recognize the month of April as Genocide Remembrance, Condemnation, and Prevention Month. The Armenian National Committee of Canada has worked with various other non-governmental organizations, particularly the Center for Israel and Jewish Affairs, the Ukrainian Canadian Congress, and the Humura Association, to ensure that each year the government recognizes April as Genocide Remembrance, Condemnation, and Prevention Month. However, this April recognition alone will not be enough. Over the past year, the ANCC has worked collaboratively with a broad coalition of human rights advocacy organizations to ask for action as well. An important part of that effort was to ask the government to combat online hate. In December 2018, the ANCC joined with 17 other organizations, many of whom are providing evidence today, in sending a message to the Minister of Justice asking that a national strategy be launched to combat online hate. This year, for Genocide Remembrance, Condemnation, and Prevention Month, we are working with a broad coalition of communities who have experienced the horror of genocide to ask all Canadians to join us in requesting that the Government of Canada adopt policy solutions to the problem of online hate. We would encourage all Canadians to visit itstartswithwords.ca and read all about what can be done to combat online hate and what other actions Canada can take to do its part to prevent future genocides and properly recognize those which have already taken place. We also want to go on the record today as strongly supporting the four policy recommendations proposed in November 2018 by the Center for Israel and Jewish Affairs as the basis for a comprehensive national strategy for combating online hate. Those four policy recommendations are defining hate, monitoring hate, preventing hate, and intervening to stop hate. We also agree that there needs to be a greater use of existing tools to address online hate, as well as consideration given to implementing new tools to assist authorities in responding to online hate. One specific area of concern we would like to highlight is that law enforcement must make hate-motivated cyber attacks or website hacking a priority. Since 2008, Armenian community organizations have been subjected to three separate incidences of cyber attacks against their online presences. The websites of Armenian Canadian newspapers, churches, and community organizations have been replaced with anti-Armenian propaganda, including, but not limited to, denial of the Armenian genocide. Despite publicizing these incidents and reporting them to law enforcement, we are not aware of any active effort to identify the perpetrators or bring them to justice. While many cyber attacks will never lead to actual violence, it is very possible that the perpetrators are linked to groups that either advocate for or actually engage in actual violence. If law enforcement prioritized identifying the parties who engage in hate-motivated cyber attacks, they may be able to obtain intelligence on potentially violent groups and prevent hate-motivated physical attacks. We also believe that the regular surveys conducted by the Canadian Centre for Justice Statistics should specifically track hate-motivated cyber vandalism and not just track victimization by individuals who have received hate-motivated messages online. Hate-motivated cyber vandalism is a criminal act
just like hate-motivated physical vandalism. And law enforcement resources should be equally allocated to investigating incidences, and Canada should work with the international community to bring the perpetrators of these incidents to justice, whether or not the perpetrators are physically located in Canada. In this regard, Canada's 2005 signing of the additional protocol to the Convention of Cybercrime, specifically concerning the criminalization of acts of racist or xenophobic nature, was an important step, but the domestic tools must be implemented to allow for the extradition of suspects and cooperation with international partners. Finally, law enforcement needs to provide communities with the tools to properly report these crimes and obtain updates about the investigation. As it stands right now, we are not clear on to whom these crimes should be reported and if they are actively being investigated or how we can find out if they are being actively investigated. The harm done to communities by hate-motivated cyber vandalism can be, in some instances, just as severe as the harm done by hate-motivated physical vandalism. The study undertaken by this committee today and in the upcoming days is a very important first step in combating online hate. We are very grateful to this committee for making room on its agenda during Genocide Remembrance, Condemnation, and Prevention Month to bring attention to this issue and to do its part in preventing future genocides. We are hopeful that this study results in an effective national strategy to deal with the pressing problem of online hate promotion. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. We'll now move to Amnesty International Canada, Mr. Neve.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Allow me to first make two very brief opening remarks. First, I very much want to acknowledge that we're gathering for this hearing today on unceded and unsurrendered Algonquin territory. And given the degrees to which online hate, amongst other things, very much plays out for Indigenous peoples in Canada, I think that's a very important acknowledgement to begin with. I also can't help but not make a gender observation as we begin. I'm conscious of the fact that both the earlier panel and now our panel, including myself, are all men. And note that two of the 11 members of Parliament in the committee today are women. And as you will hear from me in my remarks, Amnesty International is particularly concerned about the very virulent gendered dimensions of online hate. And I expect and assume that going forward that this committee will seek and will have opportunities to ensure that there's going to be a very strong representation of that concern.
I just want to, I'm not taking your time, but then I have to note that the committee did not invite individuals, the committee invited groups. So in both of these panels, the groups that were invited chose to send men as opposed to women. That was not the committee that asked them to choose by gender. No, I'm going to now give you back your time.
No, and Mr. Chair, I wasn't blaming the committee. I was just making an observation. Obviously, the question in front of this committee brings into sharp focus two crucially important human rights matters. First, the right to be free from discrimination, certainly including the ugliest manifestations of discrimination that arise through abuse and violence expressed as hate, which in far too many corners of our world continues to the extremes of mass atrocities such as crimes against humanity and genocide. A very important and stark reminder, less than 1 week after we have remembered and commemorated the horror of the Rwandan genocide, and very much a reminder on my mind as I'm freshly back from having spent time in the Rohingya refugee camps in Bangladesh, which of course is all about a community that has had to flee because of hatred. There's no doubt that the online world, which continues to transform and grow virtually daily, has become a troubling front line in that reality of discrimination and hate. And second, of course, the right to freedom of expression, often referred to as the lifeblood of the human rights system, the right to hold, to shape and share opinions and ideas, to engage with others, to take part in public debate, essential for so many reasons, including that free expression itself provides the avenues for exposing and addressing injustice, for evolving our understandings about society, democracy, and the environment in a way that make for a better world. There is equally no doubt that the online world has been a very important and growing avenue for providing new possibilities for free expression. On any given day, Amnesty International researchers, campaigners, advocates, and our millions of activists and supporters worldwide are taking action to uphold both of these essential human rights, both of which, of course, are enshrined in numerous international treaties. The right to be free from discrimination is, in international law, considered to be so fundamental that nothing ever justifies its abrogation. The right to free expression is a right that is balanced in its very formulation. The International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights notes that it's a right that carries special duties and responsibilities and may therefore be subject to restrictions only if provided by law, which are, and the key word here, is necessary for the respect of the rights of others. That word and that question really, I would suggest to you, comes to the very heart of your work. Restrictions on free expression that are necessary for the respect of the rights of others. And please do remember that word necessary, because if there is a cautionary lesson from the world of human rights protection, it is that restrictions and limitations of any kind on any right are always a slippery slope, and governments are very quick to push the limits. Necessity is absolutely crucial. The rise of hate-based and hate-fueled discrimination is on the rise everywhere, often made easier or at least more obvious by the new and accessible channels the online world offers. Misogynistic, racist hate has become a devastating phenomenon in almost all social media platforms. Amnesty International has drawn particular attention to that reality on Twitter through our major toxic Twitter research project over the past 2 years that reveals how much online abuse and violence women are subjected to. Abuse and violence that is exponentially worse for women of color, LGBTI women, indigenous women, and women from other marginalized communities. And like many indigenous organizations, faith groups, and anti-racism campaigners, human rights organizations, and others, we have repeatedly highlighted the many ways in which hate and racism represented in white supremacy has also found a toxic home in the digital world, by no means limited to simply objectionable or offensive views, but increasingly spilling over into online hate-filled discussions that stand in the background of threats against indigenous land defenders, and of course such horrific acts of mass violence and killings as Christchurch, Pittsburgh, Sainte-Foy, Quebec, and Yonge Street in Toronto. Let me wrap up with six very quick final comments and recommendations that I hope will shape your ongoing work here. First, it is commendable and important that the Canadian Criminal Code does criminalize the incitement of hatred against a growing number of identifiable groups. That does not mean, of course, that from a human rights perspective, protections against hate in Canada should in any way be considered to be full and complete. Rarely, if ever, does the criminal law offer the whole solution to any human rights challenge. Second, given the rapid rise, in particular, of online hate and its increasingly devastating consequences, governments are compelled to look for further action, including with respect to further tools for investigating, enforcing, and imposing sanctions. Third, hate, obviously, we all would agree on this, is a human rights issue, often leading to the most violent expressions of discrimination. And in our country, human rights commissions have mandates that are primarily grounded in addressing discrimination. It is therefore intuitive and obvious to consider the role that they could and should be playing in responding to this serious concern. Fourth, any move to provide a mandate to human rights commissions, including the Canadian Human Rights Commission, to address online hate should be grounded in strong recognition of the vital importance of both the right to be free from discrimination and the right to free expression, and the development of clear guidelines and criteria drawing on international human rights standards that would assist investigators and adjudicators in understanding and giving shape to the crucial interplay and relationship between those rights. Fifth, given the tension between these two rights, the legal complexities in finding the right balance, and the rapid evolution in the nature and the reach of the online platforms involved, any move to provide a mandate to human rights commissions, for instance, must involve a very serious commitment to ensuring adequate resourcing to support the training, the expertise, the research, the outreach, and the education that would be required. And finally, changes to the role of the Canadian Human Rights Commission or any other human rights bodies with respect to online hate absolutely should go forward as part of wider approaches to tackling growing concerns about online hate, including the current development of a national anti-racism strategy, measures to respond to Islamophobia, anti-Semitism, and other religious intolerance, and the need, still unaddressed in Canada, to develop a national action plan on gender-based violence. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. We will now move to ARPA and Mr. Shuden.
Thank you very much. And the honourable members of this committee are studying online hatred and what, if anything, the federal government can do to restrict it. Before we can address how to fix the problem, we need to first ask where does the problem come from and who is best suited to fix it. In a certain sense, the dark corners of the web are a window into the dark corners of the human heart. Greed, lust, hatred, anarchy, covetousness, lies infect the internet and our hearts as well. Alexander Solzhenitsyn, writing in the Gulag Archipelago, says this: the line separating good and evil passes not through states, nor between classes, nor between political parties either, but right through every heart and through all human hearts. And even in the best of all hearts, there remains an unuprooted small corner of evil. Since then, he says, I have come to understand the truth of all the religions of the world. They struggle with the evil inside a human being, inside every human being. It is impossible, he says, to expel evil from the world in its entirety, but it is possible to constrict it within each person. Charles Colson, founder of Prison Ministries International, builds on this idea in his book, Justice That Restores. He writes the following: there is no more urgent task than to restore the sense of community cohesion and to build a virtuous character into common life. Without individual virtue, one cannot achieve a virtuous culture. Without a virtuous culture, one cannot hire enough policemen to keep order. As Michael Novak has tragically observed, adapted to a Canadian audience, in a virtuous culture, we have 37 million policemen. In a culture that mocks virtue, we cannot hire enough policemen. So who is best suited to offer solutions to the problem of online hatred? I don't think the honourable members of this committee realize it, but you have actually already made a big step in the right direction when, just over a year ago, you amended Bill C-51 in order to preserve the protections afforded to houses of worship in Section 176 of the Criminal Code. Not only did you signal rightly that you care about the protection of vulnerable citizens in a state of prayer and worship, whether that's in a mosque, a synagogue, temple, or a church, more than that, you preserved protections for the institutions that can inculcate that virtue in individuals so that we can have a virtuous society. If we want that virtuous society, we need to protect churches and mosques and synagogues to continue to preach peace, shalom. Shalom. And that's where the work against online hate starts. And it is absolutely necessary for this committee, indeed all of Parliament, to understand this. Do not undermine houses of worship. Protect them and expect good things from them. However, I'm not suggesting that the state has no other role in combating violence and the senseless slaughter resulting from seething hatred as witnessed in New Zealand and Pittsburgh. The Hebrew Psalms speak to the proper role of the state. Psalm 72 says, for he, the king, will deliver the needy who cry out, the afflicted who have no one to help. He will take pity on the weak and the needy and save the needy from death. He will rescue them from oppression and violence, for precious is their blood in his sight. This psalm points to the God-given role of the state to protect from bloodshed and violence the weak, the needy, the vulnerable citizen. The Apostle Paul, in his letter to the Romans, he builds on this command. He says, the one in authority is God's servant for your good. But if you do wrong, be afraid, for rulers do not bear the sword for no reason. They are God's servants, agents of wrath, to bring punishment on the wrongdoer. So a clear application of this biblical passage to online hatred would be that the government does have a role in enacting swift justice to punish a wrongdoer seeking violence against another person or group of people. So where the vitriol of online hatred rises to the level of incitement to violence or threats to violence, which are crimes under the Criminal Code, Section 264.1, threats, 318, advocating genocide, and 319, public incitement to hatred, then the police must act swiftly to investigate, to arrest, to charge, and then to prosecute. Perhaps, and I put this out there as a thought experiment, but perhaps one impediment to swift action and to swift justice on the crimes of advocating genocide and public incitement to hatred are the unusual requirements that the Attorney General's consent is needed to proceed. Perhaps by removing those two subsections, we could increase the ability of police to pursue without delay action to stop such crimes from happening. However, one word of warning that ARPA Canada wants to share: we are very concerned about overzealous attempts to fix the problem of online hate. We co-signed a letter requesting the Justice Committee to study this issue with a good faith understanding that we'd be able to raise legitimate concerns about what would constitute going too far. We are very concerned about any attempt to reinstate a hate speech provision in the Canadian Human Rights Act. These provisions have been shown to be ineffective and often abused. They chill freedom of expression and are applied in a demonstrably unfair way. Let me give you just one example of what some commentators have described as being politically correct double standard. In 2003, in a case called Johnson versus Music World Limited, a complaint was made against a record label for a song called Kill the Christian. The lyrics of the song were read into the record by the complainant and included the following: "You," referring to Christians, "you are the one we despise. Day in, day out, your words comprise lies. I will love watching you die. Soon it will be and by your own demise. Satan wants you dead. Kill the Christian, kill the Christian, kill the Christian, kill the Christian. The death of prediction, kill the Christian, dead." The panel found that while the content and the tone of that communication appeared on their face to be discriminatory, there was, and I'm quoting, "very little vulnerability of the target group," end quote. So no violation of hate speech. And yet, 3 years later, in a case called Lund versus Boisson, a panel found that a letter published in a mainstream newspaper in Red Deer, Alberta, that made disparaging remarks about homosexuality was in fact hate speech, and ordered the writer to cease publishing in newspapers, in emails, on the radio, in public speeches, including sermons, or on the internet in future. The panel chair for both of those decisions was the same person, Laurie Andreychuk. So public policy discussions, I would argue, require as broad and as open access to expression as is possible. Freedom of expression ought to be such that all citizens feel free to speak about all public policy issues as best they can. We can preserve that freedom. We must preserve that freedom. And by putting finite resources into hate speech codes other than the criminal code, the government potentially will distract from true hate speech that leads to violence. And that's a distraction that will not do much to curb the kind of violence we saw in Pittsburgh or in New Zealand. So to conclude, my request would be as follows. One, take seriously the protection of other institutions in society that can inculcate virtue in our citizens, including religious institutions. Two, that the state needs to demonstrate swift justice against these crimes. Ecclesiastes 8:11 says, when the sentence for a crime is not quickly carried out, people's hearts are filled with schemes to do wrong. So this committee should consider removing the requirement for the Attorney General's consent to prosecute incitements to genocide and public hatred in sections 318 sub 3 and 319 sub 6 of the Criminal Code. And finally, we'd ask that we do not entertain incorporating hate speech measures into the Canada Human Rights Act. This distracts resources from the more pressing work of preventing violence against vulnerable citizens. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, and I would appreciate if you would share the links to the two judgments you referenced.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you very much. Mr. Cameron, the floor is yours, sir.
Thank you. I'd like to thank the committee for inviting my testimony today as a representative of the Baha'i Community of Canada. I'm also appearing as a member of the Executive Committee of the Canadian Interfaith Conversation, a national body that seeks to foster and promote religious dialogue and harmony. Baha'is, as members of a religion that has been in Canada since the late 1800s, and which has established communities in most localities in this country, are not the targets of online hate in Canada. However, this issue is of particular concern to our community, first and foremost because of core teachings of the Baha'i faith regarding the promotion of the fundamental oneness of humanity and the elimination of all forms of prejudice. Public or private expressions of hatred towards groups of people, whether online or offline, is inimical to these beliefs. We have joined with many other faith and civil society groups to call for the study of the root causes and potential solutions to the rising incidence of online hate, which has been directly connected to violent attacks on particular groups. Women, Muslims, Jews, Sikhs, and racial minorities have been among the most recent targets of violence that was inspired by hatred spread online. The recent attacks on Muslims at prayer at two mosques in Christchurch, New Zealand, the van attack in downtown Toronto, the attack on Jewish worshippers at the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh, and the shooting at the Islamic Cultural Center of Quebec City, all are recent examples of killers who spent extensive time in digital worlds of hatred. As Professor Richard Moon has found, hate crimes are committed most often by individuals who have immersed themselves in the extremist subculture that operates at the margins of public discourse and principally on the internet. Sadly, this is also a problem which Baha'is have firsthand experience in other countries. In the most egregious case of Iran, a government-supported media campaign of defamation and incitement to hatred has been directly tied to outbursts of violence and murder targeting Baha'is. A similar pattern has begun to proliferate in nearby Yemen. It is clear, then, that from a growing body of experience, the spread of online hatred targeting a defined group can lead individuals who are perhaps already inclined to bigoted thinking to act with violence. What should be done about this problem? Any lasting solution has to somehow take into consideration the roles and responsibilities of individuals, groups, corporations, and the institutions of government. With regard to government, I will refrain from commenting on the question of whether Section 13 should be reinstated or whether the hate speech provisions in the Criminal Code are sufficient to prosecute cases of online hate. There's a delicate balance, as others have mentioned, to be struck between guaranteeing the free exchange of ideas in the public sphere and sanctioning those whose aim is not to advance truth, but to spread hatred. Clearly, the government, by extension the courts, has a role to play in prosecuting cases of hate speech. It's also increasingly clear the policy intervention by government is needed to mitigate the impact of the more egregious misuses of online social networks. Despite recent steps taken by Facebook and Twitter to remove certain accounts, government also has a role to play in regulating these online platforms. Any effective policy intervention must ensure national and local community involvement in determining the standards for online platforms. As David Kaye, the UN Special Rapporteur on the Freedom of Expression, has urged, relying upon international human rights norms rather than the arbitrary judgments of commercial platforms is a better basis for the development of these standards. This includes delineating the rights and responsibilities of users, as well as safeguards to ensure that freedom of expression is not unduly curtailed. However, government action by itself is insufficient. There's also a role for civil society in pushing these companies further in the right direction beyond the rule of law, beyond the letter of the law, rather. One organization called Change the Terms has called on tech companies like Facebook, Google, and Twitter to take steps to curb the use of social media, payment processors, event scheduling pages, chat rooms, and other applications for hateful activities. There are concrete steps that can be taken by these powerful companies, which are accountable to both government and to the wider society, that can create a healthier public sphere for all of us. Finally, there is an educational responsibility that falls to community leaders, teachers, families, and parents. Changes in the attitudes, values, and behaviors of individuals is a necessary part of the solution. The online environment is ultimately a mirror reflection of our society. We live in a world in which prejudice against certain groups is propagated by many people, even those who do not intend to provoke violent reactions. Religious leaders have a particular responsibility to educate people to promote fellowship and concord, and not to stoke the fires of fanaticism and prejudice. Young people especially need access to education that teaches them from the earliest years that humanity is one family. They require education and mentorship that goes beyond a simplistic condemnation of hatred or a set of do's or don'ts regarding their online activities. Youth need to develop a strong moral framework within which they can make decisions about their online activities, like which content they choose to share and consume, and how they use their powers of expression when communicating with friends and strangers online. Any long-term solution to online hatred has to give due consideration to this generation that is coming of age in an information environment that is confusing, polarizing, and indifferent to their moral and ethical development. From where do young people learn to express themselves, using language that is intended to educate rather than to dismiss or denigrate? As they seek to learn about social issues, how will they know the difference between intelligent criticism and hateful propaganda? What ethical tools and social support are we giving to them as they navigate the online world? Answering these questions is a responsibility that does not fall only to government, and it is part of a response to online hate that we must all accept to carry forward. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much to the members of the panel for your interventions. We'll now go to questions. We're going to start with Mr. Barrett.
Thanks very much, Mr. Chair. Thanks to all of the witnesses who are appearing today. It's important as we move forward in the study that that you know everyone agrees that we have that we clearly denounce white supremacy. We denounce racism and intolerance directed to any group and any hateful ideologies. And I think that being aligned in that, that we have a very good basis to move forward. So to pick up on Mr. Cameron's comments on how we can encourage the reporting of online hate propaganda, because it obviously is going to take a whole of society approach to address this. The government can do what governments do. Corporations, none of the major players are Canadian corporations, so you know we need to have their a voluntary cooperation in a lot of cases to have any real meaningful effect take place. But really, Mr. Scooten had said that 37 million people working together is going to be more effective than any agents of government. So how would you recommend that we encourage the reporting of online hate propaganda? And I'll just move through the four witnesses with that question.
Well, I'll begin by picking up on some of the findings that have come out of the extensive research we've done with respect to Twitter. And I highlight Twitter not because we think it's the worst and certainly not the only platform of concern, but simply that is where our research has focused. And I think very notably, one of the very serious concerns we noted is that many people were reporting abuse, and in our report, this was focused on women in particular, and the complaints were going nowhere. That there was a profound lack of transparency with respect to the mechanisms that Twitter had in place, for instance, to address that. There was virtually no public reporting of the complaints they were getting. And this raised all sorts of concerns with respect to Twitter's own accountability. Now, totally agree with you, obviously, that a challenge here is that these massive online platforms are not Canadian corporations. That does not mean, of course, that Canadians, individual Canadians, and Canadian governments, federal and provincial, don't have a very important role in that side of things, in really keeping the pressure up on these online platforms to make sure that the possibility to do what you've raised is real and that something comes of it, that there's actually a response and action taken with respect to legitimate online hate on those platforms, and that there's more public reporting coming from the companies themselves to demonstrate the extent of the problem and what they're doing about it.
Thank you.
Yeah, reporting on online hate is tricky, and the only thing I'll say two things. One is the whole of society approach makes me a little bit more a little less afraid of overreach into freedom of expression, in the sense that we see organizations like Amnesty International and others doing these big studies and investigations and so on, which is, I think, a good first step. But as far as individuals reporting on what they see online that's hatred, what the big struggle is everybody has their own definition of hatred. And we're seeing it, I think, more and more that in I'll speak only of the Canadian context, it seems to me that we lack the ability to disagree well. We don't know how to debate anymore. And so people online in particular are quick to throw, labels like, the ending of the word phobe, so whether that's homophobe or Islamophobe or Christophobe or whatever, to anything that they really feel uncomfortable with or that they disagree with. And that's stifling a good, honest, rigorous debate about issues and ideas and policies and so on. And so, in the first panel, there was an idea of a universal button that you can click to report an online hate crime of sorts. To me, that seems that something that could be so easily abused if we're not all in agreement, at least on a baseline of what do we mean by online hate. And so I would agree with what we had said in that initial letter that came to this committee about defining hate. That's going to be a very tough decision to do, but we got to do it right.
Do I have any time left?
You have 1 minute left,
Mr. Cameron.
Thank you. I think the question of what to do with reporting is a secondary one, in a way, to what exactly the standards are against reporting is evaluated. I mean, this echoes other comments on the panel. And as I mentioned in my testimony, I think there's a healthy discussion right now about the terms that are set by these online platforms for participation in them. And I think there's a real need to reconsider what those terms are, and for that reconsideration to be done not only in response to government regulation, but also in consultation with local and community groups and in reference to international human rights standards. So I don't think it's a simple technical issue, but a reconsideration of exactly what is acceptable and what the standards are that are used to evaluate acceptable speech on these platforms.
10 seconds. Do you want to ask, Mr. Rack?
Yes, if you could.
Yeah.
Oh, hello. Can you hear me?
Yes, perfectly.
Go ahead.
Okay. Oh, just very quickly, to speak about the issue of cyber vandalism quickly and reporting of that, which was something I brought up before. So if someone were to hate on a hate motivated basis, physically vandalize a structure belonging to the Armenian community, I would know how to report that fairly easily. So if someone were to graffiti something onto my community center, I know exactly who to phone from the police and how to report that. But if someone vandalizes or hacks into my website and replaces the content with the same sort of propaganda that they would have spray painted onto my community center, I have no idea to whom to report that properly. For instance, the website may be for a Canadian organization, but hosted in the United States or in a different country. The perpetrators could be from just about anywhere in the world, and there's no way of identifying them. They have complete anonymity. We don't know if they've ever even entered Canada. They may steal data from us. They've stolen email lists, for instance, and sent hateful messages to people on those lists. We have no idea, again, to whom that should be reported properly. There should be some information provided to community organizations on how to report these sort of incidences properly, and these should be tracked the same way that physical vandalism has been. Otherwise, we underreport the incidence of hate crime in Canada. And so I think that's one thing that I would very much recommend, is that the committee work with law enforcement, especially federal law enforcement, I think is best positioned to deal with this, to figure out how this reporting should be done, to which law enforcement agencies, and to ask them to prioritize dealing with these types of instances as well.
Thank you very much.
Thanks very much. And just to note for the witness's benefit that this committee had brought an amendment to a private members bill from one of our colleagues, Chandra Arya, that gave the same protection to, for example, an Armenian community center that previously was granted only to churches, mosques, or synagogues, in terms of being a hate, at least given in the, at least in terms of the burden of establishing a hate crime. So we got you said. Thank you very much. We'll go to Mr. Assassi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you to all the panelists. I think you've been very, very helpful in terms of identifying this huge problem that we have, and something has to be done. Now, if I could start off with Mr. Neve. We just heard from Mr. Merakian that one of the problems we're having is no one knows how to navigate their way through different online platforms. It seems to me that the leadership that Amnesty has shown with respect to Twitter abuse, I think in your response you were also alluding to that, that Twitter wasn't very effective in terms of flagging online hate and being responsive to it. Have you found that some of the other online media tools are more effective than Twitter?
I wouldn't want to put ourselves out there as having done that comparison to the degree of rigor that I would feel confident in giving an assessment to you. I think what we're seeing, and I think I heard remarks in the earlier panel about this, is there is starting to be a bit of a breathlessness amongst many of the online companies of recognizing how vulnerable they are here. Some of that, I think, is coming from the right place of recognizing that there's some real culpability and responsibility for their past approaches having led to very serious abuses and acts of violence. Part of it is obviously commercially motivated as well. It has been slow with Twitter, and that's been frustrating and difficult. We are getting some pickup, and there are slowly some changes happening. But I think there's much more pressure that's needed, including from governments. I think governments need to be going on the record with companies like Twitter with very clear demands and recommendations around this whole area of change and prevention and accountability and oversight.
Thank you for that. Now, speaking of governments, we did hear earlier today about some jurisdictions or countries doing a better job in terms of combating online hate. One example that was provided was Germany. Is there any particular jurisdiction that any of our witnesses would like to refer to as an example in terms of having the right regulatory framework or the legal framework?
Not to my knowledge. I'd have to pass on that one as well.
I will too, but I will certainly follow up on that. Yeah. Obviously, we have global networks that I can access to. I don't think I would be very surprised if I came back to the committee with the gold standard anywhere. I think this is a challenge, and it's a challenge that pretty well every government is struggling with and still falling short. But I'm sure there are some good practices that we can share with you.
Thank you. Mr. Merakian, any response?
No, sorry.
Okay. Thank you for that. Now, one of the things that we've heard is the alarming rise in online hate. We've heard about bots. We've heard about all sorts of horrific numbers. One of the things that concerns me in particular with respect to certain communities is that they face state-sanctioned hate. In the case of the Baha'i community, good to hear, Mr. Cameron, that there isn't a lot of activity in Canada that should be concerning. But have we seen state actors necessarily take on particular groups? Have you evidenced anything of the sort when it comes to the Baha'i community in Canada? Be involved, perhaps?
Do you mean overseas or in Canada?
Overseas, yes, where your sense is that other states are trying to actually promote online hate.
I mean, as I mentioned in my testimony, the evidence that we have from Iran indicates there are tens of thousands of pieces of state-sponsored propaganda that have been published in both state media, but then also picked up and repeated by other actors in society. And there have been cases of murder with impunity that are directly linked to that violence. So as I mentioned, although our community has not been a target of online hate, here in Canada we're not unaffected, given the number of Iranian Baha'is who've come to Canada, many as refugees seeking shelter from violence that is, in many cases, provoked by state-sponsored propaganda, often online.
Thank you for that. Mr. Merakian, I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you the same question. Has there been any evidence of state-sanctioned hatred by other countries that we should know of in Canada?
I'm not certain if it's been in Canada, but for instance, the president of Azerbaijan once tweeted that the enemy of Azerbaijan was the Armenian diaspora, or all the Armenian people, you know, and he tweeted this in the English language for everyone to see. It's hard to know that, you know, is he then sanctioning the sort of attacks that we receive from perpetrators who are overseas, who are repeating that sort of propaganda, or is he himself just, you know, being provocative, and then, you know, what happens, happens, right? Obviously, I have no way of figuring that out. I would appreciate, you know, if Canadian law enforcement were to look into that sort of thing and figure out if there is actually state sponsorship behind some of these acts of online hatred. Thank you.
Thank you for that.
Yeah,
last,
Mr. Stassi, you have 30 seconds.
Mr. Neve, can I ask you about Section 13 of the Section 13 of the Human Rights Act? If you could comment on that, how much of a gap has been created?
As I said, we think this is something worth exploring. We recognize and don't disagree with the concerns about how some cases proceeded in the past. This is not the past, this is today. The realities around online hate are different than they were even, whatever, 5 or 6 years ago when Section 13 was abolished, and certainly in the years before that when it was being used. I think it does merit considering whether there's a role for the Commission to play here. With all of the provisos that I highlighted earlier, that it would have to go forward with a clear recognition of the importance of both rights and the kind of training, expertise, and resourcing drawing on international standards that really helps develop a sophisticated understanding of how those two rights have a profound interplay with each other.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Ms. Ramsey.
Thank you, and thank you, panelists, and for being here today. You know, one of the challenges I think in online space is people see articles, they see things that are published, they believe them to be true, they don't, you know, often look at the source. There's, I think, a general distrust in mainstream media in our country, and there's such a significant need for media literacy for people. And I think that, Mr. Cameron, you were talking a bit about education, and I think, you know, a core piece of what we're looking at here is people understanding how to identify what is a legitimate piece of media and what is something that is, you know, sharing perhaps hateful messages and things on the internet, and how to distinguish between those things and determine that. You know, I don't think that people generally have those type of analytical skills, and the members of parliament that sit at this table, we receive, you know, many emails from constituents saying, hey, what is this, you know, and they send us a link, right, to something, and you know, we're often able to say that this is, we can debunk that, or we can say that this isn't a credible source, you know, but it's a very significant challenge. So I wonder if you could each speak to the role you think that our education systems in Canada should play in, you know, combating hate in general, but certainly online hate, and, you know, whether or not you think, because I don't believe that we're keeping pace in our education system. I have two teenage sons. With the culture, with the online activity and technology, I mean, our kids are on platforms that we don't even know about, right? There are these corners of the internet where they are sharing information, and, you know, there probably aren't many parents or adults that are even in those spaces. So I wonder if you can talk about, you know, how our education system could address that, and how we can address that gap for adults as well, because I just think, you know, the invention of the internet, most of us in this room, you know, saw the internet come and got onto Facebook and all these different platforms and used it for, you know, whichever purposes, you know, sharing things with family and friends. But it certainly has grown to a place where even our understanding of what's there and what's happening there is very limited. So I wonder if you can speak to the role you think that education should play in this.
Sure. Yes, is the short answer. I mean, I couldn't agree more. And I think to frame it as media literacy is very important. I think we probably would all agree that even before the advent of social media, media literacy was always underplayed and overlooked in our education system, because even when it was sort of, whatever you want to call it, traditional mainstream legacy media that we were mainly concerned about, there were issues then as well, including how to empower citizenry about how do you engage with media, how do you make use of media. That is exponentially more the case now. And while there certainly are, I'm anecdotally aware of, including some of the experiences my own children had as they went through the education system, of some good teachers, some good practices, some good modules, there's no doubt that right across the country, at best, there's profound inconsistency as to what is offered to young people around, you know, digital media literacy in a wider context of media literacy and empowerment, and I think it absolutely needs to be prioritized.
Yeah, I'd agree. I think education is always a good thing. I guess a question for this committee would be jurisdiction. Obviously, education is a provincial matter, but certainly this the federal government can encourage the provincial governments to be pushing more on this. I think that internet safety is a big concern. We definitely pushed for that more in sex education and so on, the more awareness about internet safety for young people. And then as well, I think what would be needed as part of that is both a good and healthy definition of what hatred is, but then also a good education around how to disagree well. And I think that would help a lot as well, and it would simmer things down a bit more online, so that, you know.
The anonymous element of online, too, is something that's significant. So people don't have their real name, they're under an alias, it's a bot, you know, that you don't even really know at the end of the day, who is that really the person? Of course, we see horrible instances of trafficking, you know, this being used and luring and all these, you know, really sordid things. But when there isn't a clear identification of even who the person is, I don't know how you attempt then to stop them from what they're doing.
Yeah, I would agree that media literacy is incredibly important. I'm also concerned about hate-adjacent speech, the kind of, like, prejudice that can percolate online where it becomes funny to make anti-Semitic comments with friends or racist comments with friends in a joking way. And I'm also concerned that there is the kind of polarization we see in our society becomes then reinforced by algorithms online that push young people especially towards content that is more and more at the extremes or margins of discourse that then naturally cascades into exposure to more hateful material. So I think beyond just literacy about the sources of news, the kind of education that's required is one that goes much deeper, actually, to recognize comments as prejudicial or potentially hateful before it gets to incitement to hatred or violence.
Oh, okay. I would go over to our guest in Toronto then, quickly.
So I think the one place where the federal government does have a role in this is I think there should be more examples of Canadian history and world history about the consequences of hatred included in the resources that the federal government makes available online, especially. So there is already a Canadian Holocaust resource webpage that the Ministry of Canadian Heritage, that the Department of Canadian Heritage has online. I think that should be also for other incidences of crimes against humanity and genocide. And also incidences of hate crime in Canada should be highlighted, whether it's on the Canadian Museum for Human Rights webpage or on the Department of Canadian Heritage webpage, or maybe even Global Affairs Canada's webpage. Certain of these incidences are important in our history, and it's important to remember things like the Christie Pitts riots or and I don't remember the exact name. I know every Japanese ship ends in Maru, so the incident there with the Sikhs, and certainly with the incidences between European Canadians and our Indigenous people should be highlighted better, so that these resources are available and people have somewhere they can look and say, this is what's real.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Now we'll go to Ms. Khaled.
Thank you, Chair. I just have one question, and I'll be passing on the rest of my time to Mr. Virani. Firstly, Mr. Neve, you had referenced that there had been a study that had been commissioned by Amnesty, if I'm not mistaken. Can you share that study with the committee, please, if possible?
Certainly. It wasn't commissioned by, it was carried out by Amnesty, a study that focused on the gender dimensions of violence in the world of Twitter.
Thank you. We would love to use that as we deliberate. Secondly, just in the interest of time, I'm going to stick with you, Mr. Neve. We see social media platforms give organizations the opportunity and individuals the opportunity to pay to have more viewership of their messages and their opinions and whatever it is that they're sharing. And we've seen organizations raising money by playing on the fears of people. We've seen organizations that are paying money to these specific interest groups to spread that that very hateful message. Is there perhaps, do you think, some kind of framework that can be developed with respect to that sponsorship piece of getting your narrative out there, and I guess whoever has the most money would eventually then have the loudest voice on the internet. If I can have your comments on that, please.
Sure, and I'll be very frank in admitting that Amnesty International sometimes makes use of that. We don't have the resources that most others do, so it's a little boost on Facebook, but that's sometimes an essential part of also getting positive messages out there. But I think as a wider strategy around tackling online hate goes forward, that is a key aspect of it. The strategy needs to be looking at all manifestations of how hate finds its place and gets an even greater profile in the digital world. And if that is sometimes whoever's got the deepest pockets is going to get the greatest reach with their hate, that's got to be of top concern in any such strategy.
Thank you. I'll pass it on to Mr. Virani.
Well, generous. Thank you, Ms. Codd. So there's about 4 minutes left. So first of all, thank you to all of you. Thank you. It's good to see you again, Shahin, in Toronto. And thank you for being here. Your contributions are invaluable. A few points. So thank you for the reference to Bill C-51 and the amendments that were made. There's also been amendments made by the government in respect of the security infrastructure funding, which is the funding that we provide to increase surveillance capacity and security in places of worship. It was, unfortunately, it's been triggered by horrific events. It was doubled after the Quebec mosque shooting. It was doubled again after the New Zealand shooting. But I think that's important. Mr. Neve, you also mentioned the Anti-Racism Secretariat money in Budget 2019 that's dedicated towards that in developing a robust anti-racism strategy. These are issues that all of us care about. I, in particular, care deeply about these kinds of issues. Mr. Shuten, I want to ask you a question because it's really germane to what we're studying here. Is the issue with Section 13, is it a problem with, because, and I'm cognizant of the fact, and you seem very legally well-versed, I'm going to put to you a very strict legal question, is that the analog to that provision was tested by the Supreme Court of Canada in a decision called Whatcott, and it was upheld. There was a minor amendment about you should be able to belittle. Belittling is in the domain of free speech. But is your issue with the text of Section 13 as it then was, which has effectively been upheld by the Supreme Court of Canada, or is your issue that you raised and poignantly raised with the decision-making that took place? Because as a lawyer, inconsistent decision-making is the bane on any litigation lawyer. So where's the rub there?
Yeah. So the Supreme Court in the Whatcott decision said that having that provision, the hate speech provision in the Saskatchewan Human Rights Code, was a way that a government could to combat hate speech and so on, but did not say that it was a necessary provision. And so it's not that it's constitutionally obligatory for a government to have a hate speech provision. I would say that that's what the Supreme Court was pretty clear on. That said, I think that even post-Whatcott, that the better policy decision is to not be policing expression, even Whatcott-style expression, because it does not rise to the level of violence. It doesn't rise to the level of the types of things that were triggering this very hearing, and I think that Mr. Whatcott is, you know, I do not defend his way of expressing himself at all, but he's a person who's trying to engage in a public policy debate poorly, but that's what he's trying to do, and his engagement is particularly around political speech, and of all free speech, political speech is the most important to protect. And I think that, we can quibble about whether or not the Supreme Court got it right, but I think that it's it's playing a very fine line around that freedom of political expression. I've written, I can share it with the committee as well. I've published a peer-reviewed journal article with a law professor from University of Osgoode Hall, and on the Watcott decision and how we think that that the Supreme Court did get it wrong.
So I think that'd be helpful. So I just have just about, I've got 42, I think. Okay, so the but just
eight,
all of you,
seven.
Just all of you, in leveraging how we track better. And I'm cognizant of when we did the M103 study, people came forward and said, Muslims will report to Muslim civil society groups, Jews will report to Jewish civil society groups. B'nai B'rith, who's in the room right now, has done a great report on hate crimes. How do we leverage civil society to help us do that tracking that we've heard about this morning? Any of you?
I think it's very hard, actually, for groups to track. I mean, I spoke to the NCCM before testifying today and asked for their reporting on online hate against Muslims, and they did not, weren't able to supply comprehensive reporting. Now, this is an organization that's very well organized and does an effective job. So I think it's hard, actually, to track effectively.
I would say there's some danger in leaving it only or primarily to communities to do this themselves. There will be resource constraints, there will be fearfulness factors, there will be all sorts of things that stand in the way of that. I would say government has a role to work with communities to jointly design, resource, and maybe even run the right kinds of reporting mechanisms, that that really needs to be a joint effort going forward. Otherwise, at best, it's only going to be piecemeal. Some communities will have greater interest and capacity and resources, others less so, and the last thing we would want is, as a result of that, to have an incomplete and skewed picture of the extent of hatred in the country.
Thank you very much. And I want to thank all of the groups that participated in this panel. You have been enormously helpful to us. Thank you very much. And I wish everybody a wonderful day. Meeting adjourned.